countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
And a very good morning to you. It's John Cook sitting in for Damien this week. We'll start this morning by kicking off Heritage Week, which offers hundreds of historical and cultural events across the country over the next week or so. And one event that caught my eye on heritageweek.ie led me to Portumna in County Galway, where for many years the dreaded walls of the old famine workhouse were a place that people wouldn't dare to go or even speak about. Today that's changed, though, with thousands of visitors like me paying a visit to Steve Dolan and his team for a guided tour about life and death in the workhouse.
That's actually the front door people came in during the Great Hunger, when we were going through a time of crisis. Families came in and you had to come in as a family, and they were immediately separated out between boys, girls, men and women. These are people who had been evicted, people who had no other options. And so bad were the conditions in many of the workhouses in Ireland that many people chose to die outside rather than come in, have their family split up.
There were 163 workhouses in Ireland.
Absolutely,
and
John.
And all built in the same style. Will you open up here and show me?
The architect for them all was a guy called George Wilkinson. All 163 are in the shape of the letter H. And the idea of the H blocks, as people will know from the north, is to keep four different peoples apart. In the case of the north, it's the four paramilitary organisations. And here, it's to keep boys, girls, men and women apart.
So the whole family split up into these three-storey buildings. To do what?
Forgive the terminology, but a term they would have used is social welfare. You were supposed to come in and work for your food. But in reality, in Ireland, in comparison to England, there was insufficient work. In England, they didn't have the crisis we had here in Britain. They had an industrial revolution, so people could actually go on outdoor relief. So men would build bridges, roads, women into factories, boys and girls to farms and so on. In Ireland, when you come in, you were separated, but you were kept separated and had to work inside the four walls.
Lord, what can we do now? Lord, what can we do? They are starving, they are freezing, and their clothes have all worn.
So we're heading through what is now your new workhouse museum. What kind of work were they doing?
The men would have been put to work breaking stones up to a ton a day. They're in charge of the baking in the workhouse. The women were washing the clothes, cooking food. Children also had to work, so they're scrubbing floors, cleaning, helping out where it's needed. One of the jobs that was introduced to the workhouse was something called oakum picking. Now, that's unravelling old big ship ropes by hand, teasing them apart from the fibres. Initially, it had been introduced into prisons as a form of hard labour. This is introduced into the workhouse basically as work to keep them busy.
And this is a laundry here. Tough conditions?
Horrendous. So you can see this room here, it would have been really hot, humid, sticky, and I suppose at the end of your day's work here, you're going back into those cold dorms at night.
So where are we going now, Paula?
So heading up the stairs here, the stone stairs, we're heading into the female dormitories. So you'll see it's quite a large room with wooden floors.
There are sacks on the floor. Pretty basic. Is that a bed?
That is the bed, yeah. So these are, I suppose, replica straw mattresses that we have here. This is basically what they would have slept on. They would have had little.
So it's like a cloth sack, like a flour sack, but stuffed with straw. Will I see how comfortable it is?
A little lie down there.
Oh, yeah. Pretty basic.
They would have been side by side. If you do everything nice and fair in a space like this, you would have had 75 women. Things weren't fair in the workhouse. Overcrowding was a massive issue during the famine years, so it could be two, three, even four times
Wow.
what it was
designed. So hundreds
for.
Of people in here on these straw sacks.
So there was just one fireplace.
So we're actually going into another room where the fireplace there would have heated these other two rooms behind us.
Mm-hmm.
One fire.
Yeah, and they would have just had a blanket in here as well to keep them warm. You know, there was no toilets in here, so there was one big pot that everyone used in terms of going to the bathroom because they were actually locked in here at night time. The cold would have been a huge problem, overcrowding, disease, then on top of that as well. And just, I suppose, they would have been emotionally broken, you know, separated from their families. This, again, would have been alien to what they knew.
They have no one now but you.
This room that we're heading into here, this is the biggest room in the workhouse. This is the dining hall and it's also the chapel. So this is where the inmates, as they refer to, they ate, and this is also where they attended mass. Here, food was quite minimal. I suppose the way they decided how much to feed the inmates is they did two surveys, one of what the people on the land were eating and one of what they got in prison. So in prison, you got three meals a day. It was decided that two was enough in the workhouse. So you're actually better off in prison than you are in the workhouse. Breakfast would have consisted of something called stirabout, which is basically like a porridge. Dinner then for a grown man would have been 3.5 pounds of potatoes, for a woman slightly less, and they were your two meals a day. Children were lucky and they got an extra meal a day, so maybe some bread and a glass of milk in the evening. Very dependent again on the master of the workhouse.
He was a bad un.
The first master, his name was Henry Ogle, and he was here for 13 years, and it was because of him this workhouse in particular had a reputation for being a really evil place. You know, he was known for not changing the bathwater for up to 3 weeks. There was also a case here where a woman arrived at the doors of the workhouse. She had her son in her arms. He was dying of starvation. Henry Ogle closed the door on them and sent them on their way, and I suppose later that evening that boy was found dead in the grounds of someone's house here, all because Henry Ogle, what, he just didn't want another mouth to feed. He ends up disappearing from the workhouse, and with him he takes all the money belonging to it. We found his grave last year. He turned up in a place called Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, New York. For the last few years of his life, he himself, he was suffering from dysentery, and he ended up in an asylum as well. So I suppose that's our evil villain story in relation to here.
What goes around
comes around. Exactly.
Every nation, and Ireland is no different, tends to restore the big estate houses. But the reality is, for you and I, John, if our ancestors were involved in the historic buildings we have today, they're more likely to have been resident in places like this. Every Irish person that's alive today would have had some ancestor that would have been in the workhouse at some stage. It's from the beginnings of the 1840s up until they were closed in 1922 and 23 on independence.
And Gerry Horan, are you pleased to be here yourself, preserving this piece of history, something that, as you said, nobody wanted to talk about?
I'm 8 years working here now. I love to see kids coming in, school tours. I'd say the next day you'd have parents in. The kids go home and tell the story. Parents come visiting. So it's important to pass it on. You know, it's not that long ago at all, like, and to think what the people went through and the thousands of people that died all over the country. Like, 3 million people altogether between immigration and deaths and disease, you know. About 1 million died from disease and starvation. And, you know, we don't want to forget that.
Music there from Declan O'Rourke's Chronicles of the Great Irish Famine, ending my visit to the Irish Workhouse Centre in Portumna. And thank you to Paula Byrne, my tour guide there, and to Steve Dolan and all the staff and locals who welcomed me. I would highly recommend a visit. It's a very fascinating and moving experience. Check out heritageweek.ie for details of events there and right across the country over the coming week. But we're not done with heritage yet. What do a hurler, a lace maker, a tinsmith and a sheepdog trainer have in common? And no, there isn't a punchline if you're waiting for a joke, but they're all custodians of Ireland's intangible cultural heritage. And when we think of heritage, we often think of old ruins or paintings or treasures, but there are living forms of heritage that cannot be touched, but they're very much part of our identity. And national recognition has recently been given to 30 examples of our living cultural heritage. To tell me more, I'm joined in studio by Ken Curran from Tipperary, part of the Dry Stone Wall Builders Association. I hope I have the term right, or the
Dry Stone Wall Association of Ireland.
The Dry Stone Wall Association of Ireland, excuse me. And Sinead Igwibna of the Boyne Corrick Heritage Group in County Meath. You're both very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much for joining us.
We'll come to the stone walls in a moment. But Sinead, what's a Boyne River Corrick?
Okay, so a Corrick is a wicker boat, a basket made of hazel rods covered in a cowskin. Right. Basically.
It's a boat. People might know it, or they might think they know it. Although people have different ideas of Corrick's. Maybe it would be from a Paul Henry painting or something in different parts of the country.
Explain what's different about yours. Might relate to a Corrick as the West of Ireland Corrick's, which would be seagoing Corrick's, a long two or three or four man Corrick, where this is more of an oval shaped Corrick. So it's river based. It wouldn't work in the sea because of its shape. And it's about 6 foot by 4 foot roughly.
Okay. Tell me about its significance. Sorry, they go back in history, basically.
They go way back in history. They go way back in history. The earliest record would have been that we found would have been back in about 1366, where the Abbot of Mellifont was jailed and charged for obstruction of the Boyne Corrochs, which were carrying building materials from the town of Trim to Drogheda, and they had the right of way. But the Abbot had erected a weir at Oldbridge, which was obstructing the Corrochs. So he was charged and jailed and released later after paying a fine of £10. So that's back in 1366.
Okay.
More recently then, for in our own locality, they would have been used initially as fishing vessels. So it would have been a two-man boat where one man would be on his knees sculling, which is the figure of eight, with a paddle that looks almost like a cricket bat. And he would have been sculling, and the second man would have been releasing the net out the back of the Corroch, and then they would scoop around and pull the salmon. They were fishing for salmon in the Boyne.
And typically you'd fit two men in then, is that the
two
idea?
Two men would have been,
In so, this kind of round structure, as opposed to a long canoe shape.
Yes, more of an oval. Okay. Yeah, an oval
shape. How'd you get so involved in this yourself? Love, was it?
Well, love, I suppose, yes. I married into it. So initially Clive O'Gibna, who's my husband and the founder member of the Boyne Corroch Heritage Group, initiated this Corroch making and the restoration and the reintroducing of the Corroch back onto the River Boyne. And his family, his dad's family would have come from the locality, and his granny would remember these black boats being used. She would have referred to them as being black boats while she was down visiting her brother who lived down near the Old Bridge area. And she remembers seeing these Corrochs on the river and would have spoken to Clive about them. Now, Clive lived right beside the river all his life and was constantly trying to make rafts and different things like that. So this was sort of a natural progression for him. He's into the crafts, the basket making, the carving and all that sort of stuff. So he started back in 1997, and we've a good few now members in our group who are all interested in the restoration and the maintenance and
keeping
everything.
Keeping that tradition alive.
Yeah.
Do you love it
absolutely.
Yourself now?
I do love it. I love it. We don't use it for fishing anymore ourselves. We just purely for leisure.
Right.
So it's almost like White River rafting, coming down the Boyne, getting over the weirs and bumping off the rocks. And it's great fun. It's great fun on these lovely summer evenings.
Ken, it's not often someone comes into studio carrying a lump hammer, and a radio presenter should be in fear probably. But tell me about...
it's just a prop in case you ask me the wrong question.
About that weapon you're brandishing there. we'll come to the hammer in a moment. You're stone mad, Ken, I'm told. But a lot of people are over dry stone walls.
Self-professed stone mad, yeah. I mean, it's actually a reference to a book written by a famous mason from Cork called Seamus Murphy. The book was called Stone Mad. We often refer to ourselves as such because it's, as dry stone wallers, you have to be a little bit mad, but we also have that affinity with the material, you know.
The last time I met dry stone wall builders, I was talking about protecting them in Galway, where the Saw Doctors sang about stone walls and the grass is green, and some of them are being replaced, but there is a resurgence as well, I think, for traditional dry stone wall building. What do we mean by that? It's just dry stone.
It just means building with stone. No mortar is used. That's essentially... Dry stone is simply.
So you've got to know what you're at, so that it stands up and stays standing.
Familiarity with the material is an advantage. It's what you need to develop in order to build strong walls.
And how did you become stone mad? Was this something you grew up with? Was it from the walls or ditches where you lived? Or
no. I came to dry stone walling kind of through a circuitous route, I suppose. I qualified as an anthropologist back in the 90s, but then went to working in archaeology, and I'd always had an affinity for the stone sites that we'd work on, and as a consequence gradually became more and more fascinated by that side of our heritage, and retrained in stonework in 2008. And since then, I've been gradually growing my business and walling.
And what are you doing? Are you building walls for people's houses? I suppose people love a stone wall maybe around their new houses restoration projects?
A mixture of both, repairing old walls, building, doing landscaping for people, that kind of thing. And also volunteering with the Dry Stone Wall Association and other members to build walls as part of community groups.
So the hammer isn't for me, but what do you need it for? Do you need to sort of hammer stones into place or knock a bit off or what?
It's something that I suppose most wallers would say you don't actually necessarily need. Really, you need your hands and your eyes, but it is something that you would use occasionally, and it's probably one of the only tools you would use along with a crowbar. You know, usually the materials used as found. And that's why you get this wonderful variation in Ireland of the styles of wall from Connemara to Donegal to Wexford or Waterford, because the material varies and as a result, if it's used in its natural state, you get these different wall styles.
Very good. Sinead, what does recognition mean, this recognition for your craft, for what you talk about, the Boyne Corrock Heritage Group, to have this recognition as one of our intangible cultural assets here in Ireland?
Well, I suppose it's a comfort for us to for this the government to have given us this recognition, because the importance of the tradition of the making of the Corrock is going to be preserved and passed on from generation to generation, and with it the various skills associated with leather tanning and hazel coppicing, and also the history and the folklore of the local area as well, which is because this is a very, very local boat. You wouldn't find a Boyne Corrock in another part of the country. It's a variation of it. But the local stories and the folklore that go with the Corrock are passed on as well, which is good.
And for you, Ken, you're teaching people already or others to build stone walls, and as you said, it is spreading maybe across the country. Does this help?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, there's a commitment there from the department to help to support the actual activity, the cultural activity of dry stone walling. And for the way we see it as a step towards the UNESCO listing, because last year UNESCO themselves made an announcement that dry stone walling is an intangible cultural heritage of humanity, and we'd like to see Ireland added to that list of countries that lists it as an activity as such.
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. You can find out more by looking up the Dry Stone Wall Association, or indeed you'll find more about the Boyne Corrock Heritage Group as well. Thanks very much for joining us, Sinead Gibna and Ken Curran, who's heading straight to the match, I'm told, from Tipperary this morning. Well, you've came in good time. We'll be talking more about another great example of our living cultural heritage here on Countrywide when we look ahead to the All-Ireland Hurling Final later in the programme. Now, tornadoes are relatively rare in Ireland, with about 10 minor events recorded on average every year, but in the United States they're more frequent, more powerful, and they cause more damage to life and property. And worryingly, in recent years, the number and ferocity of tornadoes has been increasing. Last September, the American state of Minnesota experienced one of the worst tornado days in its history, with 25 hitting the state in the space of a few hours. Louise Denver met the Peterson brothers, whose farm in Northfield experienced a direct hit, and they're recovering and rebuilding on the land their families worked since the 1930s.
I'm Brian Peterson, Northfield, Minnesota. I farm here with two of my brothers and actually two nephews and my son John.
I'm Chris Peterson, one of the brothers. So I didn't get very far. I moved across the road and I got married.
September 19th, these were standing strong. September 20th, they were gone in an instant.
Yeah.
What happened?
We had a tornado that hit us directly on the farm site, and basically took about 15 grain bins down, about 7 buildings, 1 hog building, and the rest were older livestock buildings that didn't have livestock in them, and some machine sheds, and damage to our old dairy barn, but that was still standing. We lost a harvester silo in our shop. A lot of loss. We're going right into harvest. To lose our whole grain facility and our grain dryer was not fun to take.
Is it unusual to get such a direct hit on a farm like this?
Yeah, it's kind of unusual to get a direct hit, but it seems like that night there was a lot of direct hits. What I was told in our county, and a county is an area of about 30 miles by 30 miles, we had 8 tornadoes within our county that night. And we had one here, one a mile south of us, another one a mile south of there. And it did have a lot of direct hits where it took a lot of livestock buildings. And here, not so many livestock, but just plain buildings. Our largest hog building was untouched, and our homes, for the most part, were untouched. So it went between our homes and the large hog barn. It just took everything between there.
And what kind of warning did you have, or did it come from nowhere?
No, we had warnings on our, like, our cellular phones. Happened to be that night, my brothers and I were all at a visitation for a neighbor that had passed away, And so we're in this chapel at this church, and everybody's phone is going off, and everybody's like, what in the world? You know, tornado warning, you know, seek shelter. And we're just like, so, you know, curious men like we are, we walk outside, and it was cloudy and not that warm, and just not a night that you would typically associate with a tornado. But we had left the church, and we went downtown and heard on the radio that there was tornadoes heading towards Northfield and Faribault, which is a town south of here. And we thought, well, what are the odds? You know, we'll be fine. Well, I went to my daughter's place, who doesn't like storms anyway, and we kind of hunkered down there. And then got a call from my son, John, that said, where are you at? And so I'm in town at Beck's house. Well, you better get home because we've got a large mess out here, to say the least. I knew it was bad when I came out of town. We've got the hills on our road, and we could always see the tops of our grain bins as you come over the first hill. Well, I couldn't see anything, so it's like, wow. And I come over the last hill as I come down the hill to our farm, and I could see the devastation, and it was just like, wow. Yeah.
Is flattened the word?
It was flattened with the word, yeah. A big steel mess, yeah. And basically then we proceeded to clean up. The insurance company came in. We've got a clean-up clause in our insurance, so we hired an outfit that basically recycled all the steel and then all the concrete, which you really can't see here, but there's concrete under all these bins. They came in and busted all that concrete up and ground it up. So that's actually what we see out here. It's all recycled concrete.
You see, the pig shed is completely untouched.
Right.
Were the animals safe?
Oh, yeah. They were fine. We did lose a hog barn. In this picture, you can't really tell it, but there was a hog barn here also. And this bin that this, you know, flew from here through the farm shop, which sat here, and hit the hog barn, then landed and laid over the top of the barn, which is just mind-boggling.
And yet 3 meters away from it, you've got a flattened grain store. How did you find the whole experience of, I suppose, losing the property that you grew up with and the buildings that you grew up
with? Well, we were kind of in shock at first. And then we kind of got, well, it's harvest time. We got to get going and get stuff cleaned up so we can get going with harvest.
And how's farming going for you this season?
We had a really tough spring. It was wet. We got started late. So normally we'll start planting around the 18th of April. We didn't start till the 4th of May. And we planted our last corn on the 3rd of June. So it got kind of stretched out. We like to have it in by the 10th of May. So it was, I had 5 nights I planted all night. You know, it's just kind of tough. We got a late start, a lot of rain.
Have there been any longer term repercussions in terms of growing and sowing? And
we rented an old elevator down in West Concord last year to put our crop in, so it's 30 miles away, so that's been another hassle. You know, just it's so far away just to go down there, and it's old, so we're always fixing stuff. That's where we stored all of our corn.
In total, it's about 6,000 acres of corn and soybean.
Yep.
Production, fresh pack peas, canning sweet corn, hay, and the capacity for approximately 15,000 pigs. How many do you actually have here?
We've only got about 2,100 here on site. We've got the other farmers that actually grow pigs for us, so we pay them a fee to have their barn and then to basically do the chores and take care of the pigs that we own. All these, I think, pretty much the destruction that was done within the county were all Category 1. A Category 1 is winds up to 115 miles an hour, so we had been right up at the top end, probably close to a 2, but they considered this one a 1. So Category 1.
And is the amount of destruction is unbelievable.
Yeah, it took a matter of minutes and to ruin what it took you a lifetime to build. But we were fortunate. No lives were lost. Nobody was hurt. And our homes were spared. We'll rebuild and it'll be better than it was before.
Minutes to ruin what it took a lifetime to build. Brian Peterson there in Northfield, Minnesota, ending that report from Louise Denver. We've been watching developments here on Countrywide in the ongoing dispute between cattle farmers and beef factories. And this time last week, both sides agreed to talks chaired by the former Secretary General of the Department of Agriculture, Michael Dowling. Adam Woods from the Irish Farmers Journal joins me for an update. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, John.
Thanks for joining us. The protests were lifted at last. Some of them took a little longer than others. And things might have calmed a little talks to get underway again next week. What's been happening?
Yeah, I guess six farm organisations met on Monday for talks that lasted 12 hours. Beef Plan, IFA, ICSA, ICMSA, INHFA and MOCRA were all around the table. Numerous issues discussed, market transparency, carcass specifications, retailer requirements. Basically, out of that meeting on Monday, MII went away with some homework and they came back Wednesday evening with some concessions around weighing of animals on the slaughter line and including contracts, written contracts for farmers. I guess the farm organisations at that point said they were making sufficient progress not to go back to the gates to protest, and they agreed that they would be back on Monday again to meet again to discuss further issues. And I understand that the 30 months four movements and the 70-day residency rule are top of the agenda for next Monday's meeting.
More transparency and information about pricing and weights and contracts, that's what we're hearing from the talks so far, Adam. Will it mean better prices? Is it too early to say that?
I guess it's a little early to say. Some might say it's just tinkering around the edge, and really where beef prices at the moment at 340 or 350, really I'm not sure any amount of talks will be able to, you know, make money for farmers. And really, until we wake up and realise that, and MII and retailers realise that, really we'll have beef farmers going out of business, and we've a lot of talking to do there in terms of improving that price.
And some people said the Agriculture Minister should be at the talks, retailers to be invited to future talks as well. Will Michael Creed be involved on Monday?
Yeah, I think he should, without a doubt. I think there's a definite element there in terms of support for the sector. And without Michael Creed around that table, you might ask yourself, we'll say, where is that support going to come? Because the market price at the moment isn't able to deliver a price to cover cost of production on Irish farms. So definitely support payments and support for that sector are very, very important. And unless we have Michael Creed around that table, it's going to be very hard to get that support for the industry.
We'll keep a watching eye on that on Monday and await further developments. Thank you to Adam Woods of the Irish Farmers Journal there. Now, Jim and Maria Kennedy have been running a sea kayaking tour in West Cork for the last 25 years. The business has grown from Jim and Maria's deep passion for the sea and the peace and tranquility they find there. Well, wouldn't we all like a bit of that? Mary MacDonald from Grey Heron Media joined the couple at Rean Pier, Castlehaven Bay for one of their favourite activities, night kayaking. And just as the sun began to set, Mary grabbed a paddle and climbed aboard Jim's double kayak to explore the bay under the light of the stars.
It'll wobble a little now, Mary, until I get in. I always think it's like a plane taking off. We hear a noise, there's little wobbles, and then all of a sudden... Silence. We're floating.
Gently rolling the paddles.
Now, you see that? The whites of your knuckles. I call that the death grip. You don't need, you can relax.
Okay.
You can trust us. It's just nice and gentle, nice and loose, look.
It's a lot steadier than I would have thought, Jim.
Yeah, these are very stable kayaks. These boats are meant to carry a lot of equipment, a lot of camping gear and so on. So it's well able to hold us.
And just... in the water, right beside us, I've just seen a jellyfish.
Now, that one you're looking at is a brown one. They're called compass jellyfish, and those guys sting. The other ones you'll see in the wild are called moon jellyfish, and their sting isn't strong enough to affect us. Yeah, this is our moonlight, starlight trip, or our night trip. So we'll kind of become nocturnal and fade into the night as darkness comes.
And we're catching up with Maria, who is just across the way from us now. She took off at a good pace there. A fast start there, Maria.
Yeah, it's always good to get in the water. You leave everything behind, all the troubles of the day.
We're passing a tree. Its branches are dipping down into the water. You're out on these waters a lot.
This is the office, see? Yeah. So people like Maria and myself, we come to these kind of businesses with a passion, and then we have to learn the business side of it. A lot of people start up businesses and they'll pick up the passion of what they're selling or doing. People like ourselves in the tourism or adventure world or cooking or anything like that tend to come from the passion of it. There's a grey heron there.
Mm.
Now that's actually a heronry where he is. It's the juveniles on the nest. Sounds like a troop of monkeys. You wouldn't say that too often, not in Port Laois, Maria, would you?
No, no. I'm a Laois woman, so I come from the good land of Laois.
You'd be a fair bit away from the sea.
They say the only county that doesn't touch a county that doesn't touch the sea. So it's about as far away as you can get. We used to go to the sea every summer, like most families, for 2 weeks. And I lived for those 2 weeks. Just to see the sea was such an exciting thing.
And what was it about the sea?
I don't know. I kind of feel like I belong in the sea. It's a strange thing to say, but the sea grounds me. I feel better if I've been in the sea. I try to get in the sea every day if I can. I call it my 10 cups of coffee.
And how did you meet?
It was suggested to me that I meet up with this guy on the Barra Peninsula and was running an activity business. And the rest is history.
We're always wondering who fell first, but I must admit I did. I was smitten. I'd never heard a Port Laois accent before.
Yeah, that was it.
This is one of my favourite times of the night. All the birds at this stage have almost gone to sleep, roosting for the night. You hear a few odd seabirds passing by. Over on the left to the east, you'll soon see a bright light, and that's Jupiter, the planet.
And although the light is almost completely gone from the sky now, there's a beautiful velvety sheen off the water.
Isn't there just... It's so difficult to distinguish the water from the sky.
The wonderful thing about kayaking is that you can be a total beginner and be very comfortable within half an hour. There's a lot to learn in kayaking, but you don't have to learn it. You can just enjoy it as a vehicle almost, as a way to get out here.
And while we've been chatting now, the light has faded even more.
We're quite far out now towards the sea. Can you hear the waves there on the rocks?
What kind of creatures are below us at the moment in the water?
You probably don't want to know.
Tell me.
A few Augusts ago, we were just across there and 7 orcas came and checked us out. And last September, just 50 metres there to your right, there was a humpback whale breach next to us at midnight. It was quite intimidating. This guy was about 35, 40 feet long. He jumped right out of the water and splashed down. The noise was incredible because it was dark. Nature doesn't get scared with the kayaks because we're quiet and we're slow and no engines, so we get very close to lots of things. If you put your fingers in the water...
Just splash them around. I'm half afraid now what I'm going to feel.
Can you see anything?
So I just barely touch the water, and the minute that I do, it's like pure luminescent white that's coming almost out of my fingertips, it looks like to me.
You're now beginning to see the bioluminescence is beginning. There's phytoplankton, zooplankton and dinoflagellates. They're all different types of plankton in the water, microscopic, single-cell organisms. And the one we're looking at here is a dinoflagellate. And it sucks up the energy from the light during the day. And when we disturb it, it releases the energy and it causes chemical reaction like fireflies, and you start getting bioluminescence.
Yeah, it's a neon light. It's not just a natural-looking light. It's...
If you think of Tinkerbell's magic fairy dust.
Yeah, like a little bit of glitter in the water.
Sometimes the dolphins or the seals come under us and you just see their shape in the bioluminescence. I suppose it's an element I love. I love nature. But the kayaks, for me, are probably a medium for getting out into nature.
And, you know, when Jim gets a day off, he comes kayaking.
No, Maria does. The whole family do. We all love nature. We love to just throw a kayak onto the water and out in it, especially on a night like this. Such a beautiful night. I'm quite happy just to sit here. The darkness, the sky, the water. It's a bit of an addiction.
Oh,
And I can see why you'd get addicted to that. It was Jim Kennedy of Atlantic Sea Kayaking, basking in the calm waters of Castlehaven Bay in West Cork, with reporter Mary MacDonald, and some lovely sounds there in a piece funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with your television licence fee. If you fancy taking to the water yourself, Atlantic Sea Kayaking offers day and nighttime trips throughout the year. And of course, there are kayaking clubs open to beginners across Ireland on both river and sea. It's John Cook here on Countrywide, and it's 51551 for your texts. There's something about a hurling clash between neighbours Tipperary and Kilkenny that creates a great sense of anticipation. And when that clash is an All-Ireland Championship final, well, the excitement reaches breaking point. So ahead of tomorrow's showdown in Croke Park, I'm joined by two farmers, one from Callan in County Kilkenny, the other from Borrisalee in County Tipperary. Not just farmers, though, they're legends of the game who have truly great memories of some great days in Croke Park. In the blue and gold, we have Tipperary's Bobby Ryan, who has two All-Ireland medals.
Bobby Ryan breaks it out towards Aidan Ryan, sons of Timmy Ryan. It comes to Declan Ryan. Bobby Ryan waiting for the pass. Bobby has gone up in attack. Difficulty in picking the ball. He's got it 50 yards out. Swings it again towards Pat Fox. Pat Fox will strike right hand and it's gone over again. Pat Fox. Fair play to Bobby Ryan.
And in the black and amber, John Powers won four All-Irelands with Kilkenny, the first in 1992.
Meanwhile, Shawnee McCarthy batting it down at the centre of the field. Well fed back by Michael Phelan to Pat O'Neill. A day for rolling up the sleeves and doing the simple things well by both teams in towards Big Christie. Being marked in there by Dennis Mulcahy. John Parr foraging. John Parr breaking through. And John Parr scoring.
Well, our guests are very welcome to Countrywide. We're going to go to Bobby Ryan in Tipperary first. Describe the mood to me there, Bobby.
Yeah, we're a little bit nervous, but you'd expect that when you're playing Kilkenny. But yeah, I'd say it's a great feeling. Saturday morning of an All Ireland weekend is a very, very nervy time when you're playing or when you're supporting your team. But great atmosphere here, and really looking forward to the weekend.
And well, the celebrations have been massive in recent years for maybe the underdogs, places like Limerick in recent years. Bobby, some neutral fans see another All Ireland for Kilkenny or Tip maybe as nothing new, but I know from passing through both counties myself recently, plenty of flags and bunting around, painted cars and bikes. You don't grow tired of occasions like this, do you?
No, and you know, I suppose from a neutral point of view, maybe it's a little disappointing that maybe the Wexford or Kilkenny or Limerick aren't in it, or you know, even Galway. But from a Tipperary point of view, and I'm sure John will say the same, you never get tired of going to Croke Park, and we have been out of the limelight for so many years, so we're treasuring every day in Croke Park as if it's our first. And then All Ireland's don't come around, for players. You know, you mentioned in the lead up to the program, I was lucky to get two. John has four, but you know, some players go through their careers and they never get any All Ireland. So that's the lure of the game. And whether you're from Cork or Kilkenny or Limerick or Tipperary, you know, All Ireland finals are very special occasions, and they take a life of their own, and it's just wonderful to be part of it, and you never ever tire of it.
And I'll come to John Power in a moment, I hope. I'm not sure if they're having problems with the phone lines in Kilkenny there, but something fell through in the last minute or two. We'll come back to him in just a moment. Bobby, I heard Brian Cody, the Kilkenny great manager, of course, going for his 12th All-Ireland. I was listening to him with Brian Carthy last evening. The rivalry is huge, he said, between Tipperary and Kilkenny, but there's also great respect. Would you agree with that?
Oh yes, absolutely. And you know, the last All Ireland, my second All Ireland was against Kilkenny, and it's very sweet. We're near neighbours, and the rivalry is probably overdone a little bit, maybe, you know, within the players, and I'm sure this bunch of players are the same. Massive respect, and I think that goes across the board in any game, you know, and no matter who you're playing, but particularly with Tipperary and Kilkenny, they're two great hurling counties with massive tradition behind them, and the games in recent years have been classics, in fairness to them. So I think there has to be respect, because you know, hurlers and hurling, you know, it's a manly game, and it's played in the good spirit of the game. And Cody, to be fair to him, I think has brought, you know, he's brought great success to Kilkenny, but he's played a great type of game. He plays an old fashioned hurling men's game, and I think we in Tipperary appreciate that as well. And you know, we're looking forward to going toe to toe with the Kilkenny boys. But the rivalry, that's what the game is all about. And you know, we dislike each other intensely, but at the same time, you know, we love. Look at this All Ireland. If we can beat Kilkenny, this All Ireland is a very sweet All Ireland, and because of our neighbours, and then they're so close to us.
two things we talk about a lot in this programme on Countrywide, Bobby, are sport and farming. And as a farmer yourself, well, tell me, how are things for you and what kind of farming are you into?
Yeah, it's all dairy. We don't do any beef, thankfully, but it's dairying 100%. And we're having a super year on the back of probably a horrendous year last year. So, you know, that's the nature of our business, as you know yourself, John. You know, weather plays a huge part and price. So we have a good price for milk at the moment, and the weather has been superb. I mean, it's just one of those, you know, bonanza years. It's even better than 17. So, you know, a great relief from last year, because last year was just horrendous.
Come in, Kilkenny. John Power, are you there?
John, how are you, Keith?
Thanks very much for joining us. And Bobby Ryan on the line with us as well. He was talking about hating you intensely, but respecting you at the same time. I don't know if you caught some of that. We were talking about the rivalry and respect between Kilkenny and Tipperary. So how are you feeling in Kilkenny?
I'm keeping good, John. Yeah, looking forward to the game. Yeah, and great to hear from Bobby there. And
How's the mood in your camp, John? I think we're having problems with John's line again, are we? Well, look, we'll come back. We'll do our very, very best to try to get to talk to him. Bobby, what I was really interested in knowing, because recently on Countrywide, I spoke to Cork's Breach Corkery and Westmeath's John Heslin about combining sport and farming. You're not going to find many farmers on these teams nowadays anymore, are you? Maybe teachers and students. I don't think a farmer would have the time to play championship hurling, would they?
No, not the way it's structured at the moment. It's not. I don't think it's possible. Unless you have a very, very good setup and a good family network to stand in. Because training now, when John, if he's not still in there, will tell you, training when we 30 years ago was Tuesdays and Thursdays and a match on Sunday, and that was it. But now there's week camps and there's boot camps and there's all sorts of stuff, and they're getting up early in the morning to train. It's just, particularly if you're in dairy farming, I don't think it's possible, you know.
John Power, what do you think? You were farming when you were playing hurling. Could you do it now?
No, I'm not a hope. I concur with everything Bobby said. I have two chaps myself there, and we're hunting in the cows of a Sunday morning. They are mad for milk, and next thing is they turn around and they're going training at 8 o'clock in the morning.
So it makes for great competition, obviously a very high level of almost professional sport nowadays, but it's changed a lot since the game you played. Is that a good or a bad thing, John?
Sure, it is, but the balance of it, is it gone too serious now, and the sporting aspect of it, even in the stands, it'll be very tense tomorrow, Bob, as well, winners takes all, and you'd have to wonder, is the balance right in it? After all, it's an amateur sport and an amateur organisation, and you'd have to wonder, where are we actually going?
So you think, John, maybe sit back, take a look, what would you change?
Initially the GA was always a Sunday morning family day out. Everyone went hurling and playing football or what it is now, but the individual now has been actually seized out of the cradle at 12 or 14 for development squads now, and we kind of create an elite group at 13, 14, and we bring them up along, and they're in the pangs of pressure before they come to 20. Whereas I didn't meet Pat Dwyer, that played against Bobby in the 91 earlier. I didn't meet Pat until he was 21.
Right.
And we have a great friendship and the whole lot. But that friendship has been started too early now with youngsters. Youngsters have enough to deal with at 14 rather than telling them they're a county player.
It's a subject we might come back to, but we'll concentrate on the matter at hand as we finish up. And thankfully, we got you both back on the phone lines there. But I know what your hearts are telling you. Put that aside for a minute. And Bobby, who's going to win? What's your head telling you tomorrow?
My heart and my head are telling me the same thing. You know, I do expect a tight, close game. You know, and as John said, the rivalry and the tension on the stand will be palpable. But, I expect that Tip will probably have a little bit more firepower up front.
John Power, will you call it?
Well, sure. I'm hoping for a Kilkenny win. But, if Tip come to the table with what they produced in the round robin, the first three games, they were awesome, and they were everyone's choice to win the All-Ireland, even above Limerick, and they had a blip in the Munster final, and then they scored 128 against Wexford when they were on the rope. So our fellas, we have the core of a team, but we have youngsters in as well.
Okay.
But we're hoping they can get up to the performance against Limerick. They're in with a shout.
The best team win. You won't be a bad game between these two teams anyway. Thank you very much for joining us.